This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Max Abrams, assistant professor of political science and public policy at Northeastern University, who has written widely on terrorism and the Middle East. Thanks so much for joining us, Max.
Yeah, I'm happy to join you.
Let's start with Idlib, where the violence has spiked since December when the Assad regime, backed by Russia, renewed its offensive to take the last rebel-held province. Syrian attacks have killed some 13 Turkish soldiers in recent weeks, prodding Ankara to respond with a series of deadly strikes, reinforce its observation posts with 1,000 additional troops, and threaten all-out war. Temperatures in recent days have dropped below freezing in some areas, prompting UN Relief Chief Mark Lowcock to tweet on Monday, "The Northwest Syria crisis has reached a horrifying new level. 900,000 people have been displaced since the 1st of December. The 21st century's biggest humanitarian horror story will only be avoided if the Security Council and those with influence act." So, Max, who is to blame for all this and who is best placed to salvage it?
Sure. Let me answer that question by pointing out that many people, including many Jews, and I'm a Jewish person, have been appalled by the violence in Syria, and they liken it to the Holocaust. So I've seen this many, many times, describing the refugee problem as a type of Holocaust, saying that it's incumbent on the international community to do something, just as more should have been done during the Holocaust. And I really resent this analogy. And as a political scientist, I'm actually appalled by it, because in the case of the Holocaust, that was a one-sided genocide, where, of course, the Nazi regime rounded up Jewish people to their death in a systematic fashion. What's going on in Syria is very, very different, because it's not a one-sided genocide, but rather it's a war. And in a war, there is no one side responsible. So I see many ideologues who will look at the total number of deaths in Syria and say the Assad regime is to blame for whatever number it is that they cite, 400,000, 450,000, whatever the number is, or it's the Russians backing up the Assad regime responsible. But that's inaccurate. In a civil war, you really need to blame all of the fighters, and so that includes
includes
not just the Syrian government, not just the Russians, not just the Iranians, but also the rebels, Islamic State, the international community that has facilitated their rise, that has enabled them to come to the country, that has armed them and trained them and provided material sustenance. So there are many different people to blame, but anyone who blames one side, that's an automatic sign that they're not serious political scientists and they're really activists.
I think you're fighting straw men a little bit there. I don't hear hardly anybody blaming one
side. I could provide you pages.
Just let me finish, please. Yeah. I don't think many reasonable people hear that and take it seriously. So let's just leave it aside. I don't really care. Okay. I don't know anybody who says that seriously.
The major think tanks in the United States
Now, nah, well, whatever. I mean, you're making an argument against, you know, nobody. Nobody.
No, actually, I'm not. You're wrong. It's the major think tanks in the United States. So if you think they're nobody, you shouldn't have them on your show.
Tell me which think tank has been arguing that the Syrian war is just like the Holocaust.
You're joking.
I'm not.
Do you want me to go online right now and send you like a dozen links?
No, I just want you to tell me.
Well, for one, I mean, that I just saw, like with it very, very recently, was the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. But also, there have been university-wide efforts that have tried to get me to sign open letters. I mean, maybe you think the universities in America are nothing, but there are major research universities that have tried to get me to sign open letters saying that the refugees from Syria need to be taken in, just like the Jews from the Holocaust.
That's a vastly different point. You know that. Saying that Assad is committing a Holocaust against his people is a vastly different point from saying the refugees need refuge right now, just like the refugees did in World War II when the Holocaust was happening. Those are two totally different things, and you know that.
David, are we seriously going to have an interview, or are you just going to act like an activist? Here's your opportunity to speak to an actual political scientist.
What do you mean?
Let's not deny the fact. I'm asking you a question.
Do you not see the difference between those two things?
You know, I'm an expert on mass violence against civilians. So when people equate the Syria conflict to the Holocaust, it gives me the woolies. And there are all sorts of manifestations of this analogy. And I think that it's unfortunate analytically because they're so different.
I think few people would disagree that the Holocaust, you know, as a metaphor, as an analogy, is way overused. Totally. I completely agree with you. But there is a huge difference. I think you would agree that from comparing Assad to Nazis and the Holocaust, then saying refugees need refuge like people did during the Holocaust. I think, you know, the second is almost reasonable. The first, I don't think many people, I haven't seen many people arguing that, but if you've seen it, okay, I'll accept it.
And we can, yeah, we see it all the time.
Okay. So then again, I don't know if you answered the question. Who's to blame for what's happening in Idlib right now, and who's best placed to salvage it?
Well, Idlib is a contested area. On the one hand, it's part of the country of Syria. On the other hand, the international community has not respected Syrian sovereignty at all. And if you listen to Erdogan, it almost sounds at times as if he believes that Idlib is Turkish territory. So whose fault is it? It's a territorial dispute between one country and other countries that want to claim that territory as its own. But again, I mean, I wouldn't blame it only on one side. It's a function of both. It's a dispute. It's a little bit like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Why hasn't there been a resolution to the conflict? It's because the Israelis and Palestinians haven't been able to find a mutually acceptable bargaining space. The same is true with Idlib.
Right, but most people are able to say one side is more guilty than the other.
Yeah, I know, because most people you talk to are activists.
Okay, so everybody's kind of equally to blame?
It's not, I mean, I don't know how to apportion it equally, but it really depends on who you think should be controlling Idlib. So on the one hand, you could say, well, it's part of Syria. And so those foreign countries like Turkey that are trying to, wrest control of it are at fault. On the other hand, some people might say, well, Assad doesn't really have the support of the people, at least in Idlib or parts of Idlib. And so because he doesn't have their support, Syria doesn't have the same sovereignty as he would if he were, you know, a popularly elected leader. And so therefore, This creates an entrance for the international community to say that it is, welcome or legally allowed to enter into Idlib because Assad doesn't have the credibility or the legitimacy to determine which city should be part of his country. So it really depends on, where you think legitimacy lies. Does it lie with the government, or does it lie with segments of the population that don't regard him as their rightful leader?
Okay. Turkey dispatched a delegation to Moscow on Monday for another round of ceasefire talks. Those talks continued today. Erdogan has set a March 1 deadline for Assad forces to pull out of Idlib or face a full-blown Turkish assault. In a recent tweet, you described Erdogan's view this way: Syria won't be resolved until Syria pulls out of Syria. Does this mean you think Turkey should pull out and hand Assad control of the areas Turkish forces have been occupying and observing? And if so, what do you expect to happen to the people who've been in those territories?
So most civil wars end with one side demonstrating its military superiority over another. And in most cases, the side that is stronger is the government's side, right? And so from the very beginning, I have not been a proponent of the international community siding with the rebels, because what it has done is it has lengthened the civil war and exacerbated it and led to hundreds of thousands of people dying and contributed to the refugee problem. If the international community had not gotten in and sided with the weaker side, I believe that the uprisings and the early stages of the violence would have been put down rather quickly. Instead of letting the natural sort of balance of power to sort itself out organically, the international community has propped up the weaker side. I think that this is very unfortunate. Some people look at that and say, you must be a Putin troll or you must be an Assadist, but it's actually just being a political scientist. The sooner the international community stops propping up the weaker side, it will be the sooner that the Syrian government is able to consolidate control and we'll see diminished violence. So, it's very unlikely that the government is going to say, you know what, it's okay, I don't need to control Idlib, I don't need to be able to connect the various cities in my country, I can have Damascus cut off from Aleppo, that's not really important to me. I mean, that's just not how governments understand their national security. I think that a withdrawal by Turkey would be beneficial, not just to Assad, but actually in terms of reducing the unnecessary violence in Syria. But I take your point that the Syrian government has a lot of blood on its hands has mistreated the population, and that the majority of the population in Idlib is civilian, and that the violence has led to, I think, record numbers of refugees flowing out of Idlib. And what to do with these refugees, how to protect them, is a very important serious question. And I think that the world needs to do a much better job to protect these people. Large numbers of the population and the refugees are women and children, and it's heartbreaking to see their plight. And I also am sympathetic with Turkey in the sense that I understand that it has been quite generous in opening up its borders and resettling, albeit temporarily, millions of these refugees. So you know, when Erdogan says that he needs a solution to the refugee problem and that Turkey cannot accommodate more refugees, I'm sympathetic to that. I know that more than any other country, Turkey has been helpful in resettling the refugees. On the other hand, more than perhaps any other country, Turkey has also been responsible for the refugees by feeding the weaker side, exacerbating the violence, which has been the number one contributor to the refugee problem. You know, I did a study where I won some money with some colleagues, and we got people to survey Syrian refugees.
I'm going to get to that a little later. But to clarify your idea about feeding the weaker side, you're not arguing that, you know, Assad is good and beneficent or something, but you're just saying that he was in power and that it would have kept the war shorter and less death had nobody supported the rebels, yes?
Yeah, 100%.
The main problem with that is that at the start of the war, we had no idea. I mean, it looked like moment.
No, we did. It was really obvious because...
No, but you can say the same thing about Egypt, though, Max. You know, the military was more powerful than the people, but they lost. I mean, the leader was ousted. So we didn't... Nobody knew what was going to happen.
You know, what pundits have been saying from the get-go is that the Syrian Arab army is very, very weak, that Assad doesn't have support, that he doesn't have manpower, that he doesn't have the weaponry, that it's really just a matter of time before the regime gets toppled. And this basically created false optimism among the rebels and encouraged the international community to feed the weaker side. But the reporting on this, in terms of the relative capabilities of the Syrian Arab Army and the rebels, has been off.
I don't think I'd argue with that, but I'm just saying, like, the difference seems to be that, you know, Assad was willing to shoot his own people and Mubarak was not. But we didn't know the extent what that would go to, you know. So you know, the U.S. and all these other countries backed the rebels because they thought it was the right thing to do. And it did. It probably did extend the war and lead to more violence and death. I don't know if I can disagree with that, but that doesn't make Assad's position any better today, I don't think.
What do you mean by better? Normatively or analytically? What are you talking about?
Reasonable, moral, humane, legitimate, let's just say.
No, I mean, I don't argue that... for the, you know, that Assad is humane. I'm just telling you, based on the Civil War literature, backing up the weaker side and feeding the rebels with weaponry tends to extend civil wars and create more violence. Mm-hmm. And when I actually surveyed Syrian refugees from many different countries, what they said is that they were fleeing from the violence. And that it wasn't just that, you know, they were fleeing the Assad regime, but they were fleeing the violence created by the civil war. What I think the international community should do is not, you know, try to demonize one side, not say, you know, who is responsible for 100% of the violence, but try to figure out ways of reducing the amount of violence in that country. And the best way to do that is actually for there to be less international involvement.
Right. I mean, it's hard to do that at this late stage, but so just to continue the point you made a minute ago, in an October 2017 piece for Foreign Affairs, you wrote that the Western media had whitewashed Syrian rebels in order to sell their case for regime change. So is it your view today that Assad's rule is legitimate and that his continued military aggressions, like in Idlib, are justified because he's clearing his territory of terrorists?
David, who are
just
you?
Just let me finish the sentence and then you respond, please.
Who are you used to speaking with? Like, no, I'm not going to argue that Assad is legitimate or humane, or I think that you're trying to get me to say something that I don't say.
I'm just asking you questions. You are free to respond.
That's not my position, dude. I'm not Tulsi Gabbard. You know, I'm not going to apologize for Assad's crimes. That's not what I do.
I don't need you to. I'm just asking a question.
So no, I don't. I'm not going to do. No, but you've asked me to answer whether I think he's like legitimate or
right. So you say no, and you explain your position. That's why I ask questions, to get your position.
Yeah.
Should I do it a different way? I don't understand.
Well, I mean, you should stop pretending as if you're, you know, arguing with like someone who works for.
I'm not pretending at all. I'm asking you your view. Can you just tell me?
Sure. Why don't you repeat verbatim your question?
So is it your view that Assad's rule is legitimate and that his continued military... Can I just finish the question and then you can answer? Are justified because he's clearing his territory of terrorists?
Yeah. See, I wouldn't really say that, no. I'm not going to say that Assad is humane or that he's justified or legitimate, to use any of the language that you've put into your question.
Okay. So you'd say, so how would you describe it? That's what I'm wondering.
What I will say is that, like other leaders, Assad wants control over his country. And Idlib is a very important remaining outpost of opposition. And so given his desire to consolidate power, he is going to continue to try to take back Idlib and to stamp out the militants who are opposing his rule.
I mean, the problem is there have been widespread reports of Assad and Russian forces targeting healthcare facilities and IDP camps. And they claim, they say, and yes, there are, you are right, terrorists. There are jihadis in Idlib, many, HTS mainly. But, you know, there have been many documented reports of them targeting civilians. And there are suggestions that this, they might do this more if Turkey were not there. What's your view on that?
My prediction would be actually the opposite. That Turkey's position there actually exacerbates the civil war, and that if they were to leave, especially if Turkey could do what it promised to do, which was to dissolve the jihadist groups there, especially HTS, that there would be less violence from the Syrian Arab army and from Russia.
So you,
I mean,
but you just said that Assad.
David, let's do a thought experiment.
Okay.
In areas where there are not so many jihadists, is the Syrian military bombing in the same way as it is Idlib? Are there any other areas that are purely civilian, where the Syrian side is harming the population as much? Can you think of any?
No, but that's just my point.
But that's actually my point, which is that therefore, if there was less support for the militants, Idlib would look like the other towns in terms of how the Syrian military interacts with them.
No, but there are more militants and terrorists in Idlib. So the government wouldn't suddenly give up if Turkey left. It wouldn't stop fighting them. It wouldn't stop bombing them, would it?
Well, I think that it would weaken the position of the jihadist fighters because they wouldn't have the backing of Turkey. And again, going back to the literature on civil war, I think that there would be greater asymmetry between the government and the militants which would reduce the intensity of the violence. But the very fact that Idlib is taking the brunt of the of the Syrian military's violence, I mean, it's not a coincidence. It's because that's the area of resistance. So if Turkey were to stop propping up this resistance, I believe Idlib would look more like other towns and cities in Syria where there isn't as much violence and where the population doesn't suffer as much.
Right, and then the war would be over and then things would change, yes. As I mentioned before, the main rebel group in Idlib these days is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HDS, which is linked to al-Qaeda via a previous incarnation, Jabhat al-Nusra. You recently wrote on Twitter about rumors to dissolve HDS. What's the latest you've heard on that, and how do you think the group is doing in Idlib these days?
I have seen a bunch of rumors about HTS dissolving. I don't have any special insight. I really saw the rumors swirling maybe 2-3 days ago, but it's not the first time. I'll be curious what happens to HTS. It's frankly a confusing group because it rebrands itself, it changes its name. What exactly is its relationship to Turkey? How much control does Turkey have over it? Will the group simply change its name? Will some of the fighters go elsewhere? Will they go to fight in Libya? I think right now it's a bit of a waiting game. When I look at, so on the one hand, I'm seeing reports on the Syrian side where they're celebratory. They're enthusiastic and they're quite pleased because they've been able to make gains into Idlib and to secure the M5 highway. There's talk about the M4 roads. And so you might think that this is a really big turning point. But on the other hand, I've also seen reports that Erdogan seems as committed as ever to Idlib, and that over the past couple weeks has been reinforcing Turkish positions, sending in a bunch of convoys. And that indicates to me that the fighting is going to continue. What HTS does is really something I'm interested in, but I don't currently have the answer to.
Yeah, as part of the 2018 Sochi deal, Turkey was supposed to remove all jihadis, particularly HTS, from Idlib. It has failed to do that, and now it is essentially, as you say, allied with HTS and facing down the Assad regime offensive. In response to Russian and Syrian claims that they are fighting terrorists, Erdogan said a few weeks ago, are those defending their own land terrorists? They are resistance fighters, which I think is funny because I think officially Ankara views HDS as a terrorist group. How confusing it gets.
Right. So, I mean, there's no consensus over the definition of terrorism. This is true even among academics, and it's particularly true among governments. And the reason why, of course, it's not a coincidence, it's because the term terrorism is used instrumentally to delegitimize opponents, or alternatively, calling them rebels is more conducive to supporting them. So the fact that there's disagreement between the warring sides, where Syria regards HTS as terrorists and Turkey doesn't, that's to be expected. Even among academics, there isn't a consensus over the definition of the term, but among social scientists, particularly those who work in North America, we tend to identify terrorists as non-state actors. So we're talking about an individual or a small group or a larger organization who uses violence against civilians or non-combatants for some sort of a political goal. And based on that criteria, it's fair or analytically correct to describe HTS as terrorists. So I have no problem with calling them terrorists. That said, you might also say that they're freedom fighters. Sure, do they want to control territory? Do they have a measure of popular support? Yes, they do. So that's true as well.
As you mentioned before, you co-authored a report on Syrian refugees that was released last week. One finding that struck me was how easy refugees still say it is to enter Europe despite the increased security measures of countries like Turkey, especially after this 2016 deal with the EU. Three of every four refugees you spoke to said they'd been able to enter Europe on their first attempt. Who's to blame for this? European states, Turkey?
Yeah, I think that that European countries don't really have strong border control, and they need to, for the sake of national security and even international security, they need to understand who's coming into their country, even if they want to have a very generous, refugee admissions policy. It's important to keep track of everybody. I think that there's variation in terms of the different countries in Europe. Certain countries, they really didn't know who was coming into their country. An example would be Greece, for example. There were times when Greece was admitting, 10,000 refugees in a day, and they really just didn't have a sense of who was coming in. So yes, it has been very easy for Syrian refugees to get into countries, and we don't, these countries don't have a good idea of, who's in their country, and that's a security problem. In the United States, by contrast, due to its geography, and frankly, due to the ideology, there is much better border control. It really cuts both ways. On the one hand, it's better in terms of patrolling our borders and knowing who gets into the country. But on the other hand, it can be unfortunate because it can prevent people, law-abiding people from seeking safe haven.
Some of the refugees you spoke to talked of being imprisoned, shot at, and beaten by Turkish security services, but they had mainly nice things to say, it seemed, about the people smugglers, who are widely denounced in the press as exploitative. I thought this was an interesting contrast with this, the way the smugglers are presented in the press compared to Turkey welcoming these 3.54 million Syrian refugees.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too, because most of the stories that I'd read about the smugglers were negative. It spoke about them as opportunistic and exploiting human tragedy. We got a different perspective from the vantage of the refugees, who seemed relatively happy and almost appreciative to the smugglers, but then found themselves the target of discrimination once they got resettled in Europe. There was a lot of xenophobia and mistreatment to them. I think that probably many of these refugees were escaping basically the clutches of death in Syria. And it's extremely sad to think that they would then arrive in a new country only to be mistreated, sometimes by that nation's security services.
Back to Syria, the U.S. seems to be pivoting back to a Turkey first strategy there. Last week, yeah. You described U.S. envoy James Jeffries saying the U.S. stands with Erdogan as a shameful position. Why do you say that?
Well, I do think that, just going back to my original statement, that the U.S. siding not only with Turkey, but the broader international community with Qatar, Saudi Arabia, just pouring in the refugees, supporting the opposition, even enabling extremist fighters, including Islamic State, to set up a caliphate in Syria, has been counterproductive. It's been counterproductive on all sorts of levels. It's been counterproductive for the international fight against terrorists. I think that it's been counterproductive for the local population. I think that it's been dangerous geostrategically or geopolitically in terms of putting unnecessarily the U.S. and Russia on opposite sides in the Syria conflict. I think that that one of the lessons was, over the past several years, really, since the outbreak of the revolution and the Arab Spring, has been the U.S. tilt to the side of Turkey. I don't favor that position. I think that it's been counterproductive on many different levels.
What about the U.S. partnership with the mainly Kurdish SDF in the fight against ISIS, which by most accounts was successful and did, it should be mentioned, upset U.S. ally Turkey? What did you think of that partnership and the ending of it?
Yeah, I mean, I was early proponent, actually, of the U.S. Getting involved militarily against ISIS and supporting military strikes against ISIS in Syria before the U.S. did that. Because you'll remember that initially the U.S. was really only going after ISIS in Iraq and not yet in Syria. I also was a very early proponent of the U.S. teaming up with Kurdish fighters. Under Obama, Obama was one of the reasons why he was elected president was because he opposed the Iraq War and was seen as understanding the limits and dangers of using U.S. forces on the ground in counterinsurgency. John Kerry also, he was deeply affected by the lesson of the Vietnam War. And so what the Obama administration needed to do was it needed to confront militarily Islamic State while respecting their own sort of prejudices against using large numbers of U.S. ground forces to fight ISIS. And so what that meant was that we needed to delegate, we needed to find some reliable ally on the ground to work with, to serve as our ground forces. And from the very beginning, I was a proponent of using the Kurdish fighters. Mm-hmm. And those who were pro-rebel, you may recall, very often said that, no, we needed to use, Arab fighters. We needed to use the rebels and not the Kurds, that the Kurds wouldn't be effective. People like Hassan were big opponents of early usage of the Kurds because they said, no, we need to use the Syrian, the so-called rebels. And from the get-go, I said, no, let's not use the so-called rebels. Let's use the Kurds. And after the Battle of Kobani, my position gained popularity, particularly when increasingly the rebels became tainted with extremists like Nusra. So I've been a longtime proponent of not using the rebels and instead of using and helping the Kurdish fighters, bolstering them long before we even came up with that nomenclature of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, which, of course, I also supported.
Even though it was going to inevitably lead to some blowback with Turkey, as it did this past fall.
That is absolutely a fair point to make, is that that U.S. support for the Kurds was short-sighted. That it was absolutely inevitable that it would create conflict with Turkey. And I actually am sympathetic on this to the Turks, because I do understand that Turkey has a legitimate terrorism problem and has for decades with the PKK. And I also acknowledge that there is a lot of overlap, a lot of legitimate, credible overlap between the PKK and the YPG and the SDF, and that by the U.S. siding with the Kurds, effectively, the U.S. is bolstering Turkey's terrorist enemies. And so that was a short-sighted plan that was understandably objectionable to Turkey.
In your 2018 book, Rules for Rebels, you came up with three golden rules that militant leaders must follow to win. One, don't kill innocent civilians. Two, create a highly centralized structure under a clever leader. Three, maintain your brand through total denial when things go wrong. So I wonder, how do you think the PKK and its Syrian affiliate, as you mentioned, the YPG, how have they done on these three counts?
Yeah, well, thanks for raising that point. So what I did
You led me into it perfectly.
Thank you. So in the book Rules for, so when people think about terrorism, they tend to think of it naturally from the victim's perspective or from the government's perspective in terms of how do we make counterterrorism more effective. I kind of turn that on its head and I look at militancy from the vantage of the perpetrators. And the main question that I ask is, what's the best approach from the vantage of the militant groups in terms of achieving their goals? And I look at hundreds of groups throughout the world going back really to the beginning of our data record in the early 1970s, if not earlier. And I try to discern scientifically what rules militant leaders can follow to optimize the likelihood of political success. And what I found is that by following three rules, militant groups are significantly and substantially more likely to achieve their political aims. And the first rule is that militant groups should spare civilians, that not all violence has equal utility for them, and that they're much better off in terms of using selective violence against military and other government targets rather than indiscriminate violence against civilian targets. However, it's not enough for the leader to simply understand that it's good to stay away from civilians because he also needs to exercise a certain amount of control in order to impose his tactical preferences on the rank and file. And the best way to have this control over his fighters is to centralize the organization because the more decentralized the group, the more tactical discretion the fighters have, and therefore the more likely they are to strike these politically suboptimal civilian targets. And so when the leader opposes civilian attacks and when he centralizes the group, groups are substantially less likely to attack civilian targets and therefore more likely to achieve their political ends. However, even when the leader follows both rules one and two, sometimes militants still attack civilian targets. And so the third rule is for the leader to augment the public relations of the organization when wayward operatives have besmirched the group by engaging in terrorism by attacking civilian targets. And so the best way to do that is for the leader to try to distance himself from this violence by blaming it on rogue elements within the organization, by apologizing for it, by publicly punishing the wayward fighters who engaged in this civilian carnage in order to demonstrate that the leader of the group isn't happy with this kind of violence and that the group is actually more moderate than this kind of terrorism would make it appear. I actually think that the Kurds have been very savvy. And I think that they have done a better job in terms of respecting and following the rules for rebels than many other groups. I think that certainly when it comes to relations with the United States, you don't see Kurdish fighters blowing up American civilians. You see pretty good command and control by the leadership in terms of trying to direct the group's violence against terrorist enemies of the United States, especially Islamic State. And so when Americans think of Kurdish fighters, for this reason, they don't think of terrorists, they think of counterterrorism forces. That said, from Turkey's perspective, the Kurds look very different because, of course, the Kurds have been responsible for thousands of deaths on Turkey's side. So it's understandable that, you know, that the PKK would be understood as a terrorist group. So target selection absolutely matters in terms of how governments regard these groups and how they interact with them and whether these governments support them militarily or want to fight against them. So I think that the Kurds have been quite savvy in terms of winning over American support. But of course, not savvy at all in terms of winning over Turkish support. I also think that Al-Qaeda in Syria has been relatively savvy. I think that it's smart for Nusra to change its name, to try to distance itself from the Al-Qaeda brand and to try to pitch itself as freedom fighters and resistance fighters rather than a terrorist group that directs its violence willy-nilly against civilians. By pitching itself, by depicting itself as an anti-Assad fighting group, this is the kind of PR message that resonates in the international community because, let's face it, the Assad regime is reviled. And most countries in the world, probably every country in the world, with the exception of Russia and Iran, have been opposed to the Assad regime. So to the extent that Al-Qaeda fighters or former Al-Qaeda fighters can position themselves in a PR way, not as terrorists, but as anti-Assad fighters, this is the kind of winning message that will attract international support and which will spare them the kinds of international counterterrorism campaigns that Islamic State, for example, found itself targeted by.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So it's like they've been whitewashing themselves. They haven't even needed the Western media to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination. But I would say that one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda in Syria has been able to do as well as it has done. And it has done quite well. I mean, whenever I talk about Al-Qaeda in Syria, I have, Syria specialists say, oh, it's, that's so ignorant. They're no longer formally part of Al-Qaeda. They've changed their name. Fair enough. I mean, all of that is true. But nonetheless, what you have is you have fighters who formally were publicly part of Al-Qaeda's affiliate, and they've undergone name changes. And even today, while Idlib is suffering at the hands of the Russians and the Syrian military, I would say they're still doing better than Islamic State, which doesn't, sure, I know ISIS isn't dead, ISIS continues to mount operations, etc., but ISIS doesn't control any territory in Syria in a way that HDS has. HDS was able to preserve its territorial control longer than ISIS. Raqqa was lost before Idlib. And the reason why is precisely because HDS was more moderate. Now, some people might be surprised to hear me say that because I have been one to identify HDS links with terrorism. But nonetheless, in terms of the continuum, there's no question that HTS is not ISIS. Mm. And because of that measure of moderation, it's been able to attract more support from the local population. More Syrians have always supported, HTS and its constitutive groups than they did support ISIS. So they have more local support. Other militant groups have been, sometimes they've fought against HDS, understood, but they've also been more likely to align with HDS. And of course, the international community has been more in favor of supporting HDS than it did for ISIS. And all of that is because HDS has done a better job of following the rules for rebels. If I were to give advice to HDS, I would encourage it to continue to be more moderate, to separate itself even more from Al-Qaeda, to turn against the most extreme elements in that group, to disavow any kind of attacks or mistreatment to the local population, and to focus its violence squarely and uniquely against military forces.
Shifting over to Libya for a last couple of questions, if you can. Your view is that in Syria, the involvement of foreign players, the international community extended the war and increased the death and destruction. I wonder what you think of what's happening in Libya, where Turkey has sent some 6,000 Syrian rebels and Russia via the Wagner Group has sent a couple thousand mercenaries. And there's also been the involvement in the UAE and Italy and France, as I'm sure you know. What do you think about the situation there? How might the international community begin to solve it?
I mean, like in Syria, there is plenty of blame to go around. We need to blame Gaddafi for being a despot and for mistreating and, frankly, killing, you know, his own citizens. We need to blame the international community for its military campaign that removed him. Yes, I understand that the stated goal wasn't regime change and that it was a combination of the no-fly zone and air power coupled with, you know, whatever you want to call them, militants, rebels on the ground that directly led to his death. But it was an international effort. And I think that removing him, although he was a despicable person who mistreated and oppressed and killed not only his own population, but sponsored terrorism around the world, I still think that Libya would have been better off with him in power. So I also blame the international community to the extent that it removed him. I blame the international community for how it's handled Syria after he was removed. In terms of exploiting the power vacuum, you know, from day one, like Qatari influence, Sunni Gulf influence. I think that the United States and European countries didn't really care what happened to Libya as soon as Gaddafi was removed. And now I see and I have continued to see over the years, all sorts of countries around the world looking at Libya as an opportunity to serve their own national interests, whether it's Russian influence as served through the Wagner Group, or it's the UAE, or it's Turkey. I call it the Olympics of international militancy, because there are so many different countries that have some sort of presence, often a proxy group presence, and they're in there for all sorts of different reasons, to exploit financial advantage, commercial relations, to flex their might geopolitically in terms of maybe as a counterforce to NATO. I don't think that there's a single foreign country in Libya there with the interest of the Libyans at heart. I think that this is a classic example of realism, where we're seeing nations project their power, and the primary losers are the Libyans. There are no good guys in Libya, just as there are no good guys in Syria. And yes, that includes the Assad regime. And so the first thing that the world needs to do is it needs to allow Libyans to take control of their own country. All of this external involvement, the mercenaries, the militants, the weapons, it is just fueling this war. And it will not peter out until the international community has a real embargo, not the one that was talked about a month or so ago, but a real one, because it's a disgrace.
So it sounds like you're against any sort of intervention. Do you advocate isolationism or particular instances of intervention?
I tend to look at this from the U.S. Perspective generally, although I also do think about, what are policies that would help the local population and try to limit unnecessary suffering. And when I look at the biggest mistakes that the U.S. has done in terms of U.S. national security and in terms of the plight of local populations, regime change really screams out to me as the number one culprit. I think that the original sin in the Iraq War was the biggest foreign policy mistake of my generation. I think that removing Gaddafi was a colossal mistake. And although Assad wasn't removed, of course, as all of your listeners know, it is true that the international community did favor a policy of regime change, or at least supported with billions of dollars, militants on the ground who were mainly interested in regime change. And I think that this, all of this external involvement to basically determine the political systems of foreign countries has been deeply counterproductive in terms of inflaming our terrorism problems and exacerbating civil wars.
So what's the alternative? You
contrast that with my strong support for U.S. military attacks against ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. And what comes out of this is not that I'm an isolationist, and it's not even that I'm dovish. I'm absolutely in favor of U.S. kinetic involvement against terrorists, but I'm not in favor of the United States trying to determine foreign governments. So there's a big difference. I think that we can use drones. I think that we can use special operations forces where we need to. And I think that we can even team up with fighters on the ground who are reliable partners like the Kurds. So I'm not dovish on counterterrorism, but I am opposed to trying to remake foreign countries in terms of determining their governments. That's really a decision that needs to be made by the citizens of those countries. I understand that oftentimes there will be a war to sort out the balance of power, but that's just the way the international system works.
I hear you. That's a reasonable perspective. The problem is that some actors, China, Russia, Iran, are going to meddle in other states' affairs, and so shouldn't the U.S. do something about it rather than sit on its hands, or should it just accept a influence in certain places?
I think that when the United States wants to get involved in these countries, it needs to exercise a lot of discretion. It needs to ask itself and really study this issue in a way that American officials almost never do. The U.S. needs to understand the dynamics of these countries much better than it does before intervening. There needs to be one side which is, substantially more moral, one side that isn't committing atrocities. They need not to be terrorist tainted. There needs to be an expectation that the U.S., by getting involved, will actually have a meaningful impact in terms of making the situation there better. And the U.S. also needs to consider how other countries, including other strong, important countries around the world, like Russia and Iran and frankly, and even Turkey will respond to the U.S. Intervention. These are the kinds of calculations that American officials need to make. So again, this is different than other conflicts where some people will say to me, well, what about, you know, Rwanda? Or what about the Holocaust? You don't think the U.S. should have gotten involved there? And the answer is, in my opinion, that's different. It's different because the nature of the violence was different. It was easier to see the good guys from the bad guys. That was very clear in Rwanda. It was very clear in the Holocaust. This was more of a one-sided genocide. In the case of Rwanda, the U.S. and the international community and reports show this, could have intervened earlier and really made a large difference in terms of saving innocent people from being macheted to death. Furthermore, I think there could have been international intervention in a way that wouldn't have created a major, major geopolitical problem in terms of putting great powers at odds with each other. In the case of Syria, it's not as clear cut. In the case of Libya, it's also not clear cut. And in cases where it's not clear cut, my bias is for the U.S. to do less, not more.
Okay. Well, we've just crossed the hour mark. I think you could probably keep talking all day, but I should let you go. Max Abrams, thank you so much for talking to us. Thanks for your time and insight.
All right, my pleasure. Thanks, David.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.